Tanmay Tatanga. Tanmay has one big advantage, which not all of us have. He is located in New Delhi.
And
has got some disadvantage also, because he gets a lot of phone calls to provide free services. But at the same time, he is able, I think, and we have seen also the results of that, to influence in a positive way, in an energy positive way too, some of the policies. And that advantage not many of us have. So we look forward to hear some of the insights that Tanmay will share with us on the subject of energy efficient design.
Thank you. Namaskar. It's trying to use some of that za energy. This is the last but one presentation, and anyway, throughout the day, I think almost everything that I had to say has been covered, and Dr. Mohanty, you just made it even worse. You are supposed to be doing audit, not design. You know? So, this is a presentation which I've been tweaking while I've been listening to others, trying to trim things and add a few more that may be of interest, that looks at the context. I may be throwing a few more global numbers and a few more local numbers at you to set the context of why in buildings it's important to look at this and what can be done and what the process is. Tomorrow we have a workshop where it's going to be focused more on two or three aspects, but one is go more in details of what is the process of actually making an energy-efficient building. What are the barriers that we all face? I feel that many of you are, from the list that I saw, already practicing a lot of these things. So what are the barriers that we face that we can overcome? And we probably will have an hour or so of a site visit of an interesting building that we will see tomorrow that encompasses a lot of these principles. So, I will refer back to this concept of ecological footprint. You already know what it is. This graph shows the ecological footprint of countries. And this is where India is right now. This is old. This is almost 10 years old now. This is 2003 data. And it's published in, I think, 2005 or 6. And can you guess which countries are these?
Qatar.
First one is UAE.
We'll go a little bit more in detail.
So the first one is UAE, then USA, Finland, Canada, Kuwait. US is almost at this point, right?
And this is where we are.
So we were. I think things have changed a bit, but we're not that far. We still have maybe 15, 20 odd countries in an ecological sense performing better than us. But what is our aspiration, right? Our aspiration is to go here. Right? This is Europe, this is US, and I think half of us already have family in Dubai. Right? So, the other interesting number is how it is the footprint is related to GDP growth. You know, when we experience this fantastic growth that everyone is envious of, the trends from, say, this is India between 61 and 2001, that was a period, it was not a very high growth period for India. Whereas some countries like Thailand were growing very fast, and you could see a trend that shows the GDP growth linked to the decline in footprint. This is what, for example, China did, and this is what we are doing right now, what Korea did in those 30 years. So, as the GDP grows, our biocapacity goes down, and our footprint goes up. Those things are closely linked. If you look at this is a chart, it's a very interesting report done by WRI, the World Resources Institute, that mapped a lot of these flows of resources and emissions. So you look at the big things, transport, 13.5%, electricity and heat about 25%, out of which residential building, commercial building, then industry, and other things that we talked about, production of electricity, the losses, land use changes, agriculture, waste, industrial processes. Now, in this end use activity chart, you can see that when everything is proportionately allocated, commercial and residential buildings still hold, in a global sense, from the primary energy source, still almost 15% of emissions. And this is when I would say at least two or three large economies are largely underserved. Underserved in terms of services, where countries like ours still have a long way to go in terms of even providing the basic end-use services that Dr. Mohanty talked about. I mean, you know, comfort, for example. So the model that we have to follow is this, right? So this was the GOP per capita electricity consumption and the Human Development Index. And, you know, we want to aspire to go up and have a much better Human Development Index. And the trend is to go that way. So the link between our development and electricity consumption is almost, it's a 1:1 relationship. That for every step that we increase our comfort, our standard of living, we are paying for it almost in the equal terms in terms of energy use, electricity use. But there are examples where countries have done slightly better. And there may be several other reasons why they're doing it, the amount of resources they have and geographical locations, populations make a difference. But still there's a path for us. There is a path that at least we know what to avoid, let's say. And when we aspire for this index of better living, we do it at, I don't know how, I mean, this Aro has a similar slide that shows that it actually is possible with sort of planned growth. And that looks at, you know, another interesting data here is the projected emissions for countries. So, you know, in 2025, the emissions in developing countries are going to go up to 84% from where they are now, an increase of almost 84%. And you see India is almost a 70% growth in that. But what is very interesting with all these numbers is the uncertainty of it all. This is the uncertainty of Indian. This is the projected CO2 emissions. This is the low estimate and that's the high estimate. Right? So there is such a big opportunity in this uncertainty for us. So it is up to us to a large extent which path we choose, because if we go by the current standard of doing things, we would definitely end up there. And if we have an alternate scenario where it's not just efficiency, it's also the resource use, the way we develop our cities, the way our transportation increases, the way our power and energy policies, we could even shoot for this. And these are all official, there's nothing official about it, but these are internationally accepted uncertainties. So, the dilemma for us is that, of course, the affluent and the people who already are enjoying services have to cut down on the intensity of resource used to enjoy that same level or maybe a reduced level of service, which is a tough sell. You can never ask anybody to, I mean, you know, changing a set point in a family is a trouble. How can you ask your neighbor to change a set point? But for us, in large nations, developing economy, we have to improve our quality of life. So the challenge is looking at how do you do this, reducing the wasteful nature in which the other economies and the other technologies work. Now, in all of this, where do buildings fit in? These are standard numbers, and you know, even I don't know what the source of all this is, because you know, 40% of the world's energy goes in buildings. It's still not very clear to me, because it may include the building, what the occupants of the buildings do. So anyway, it is routed through buildings, let's say, 40% of energy, and you know, a lot of changes have happened in other sectors where the visible environmental impact was so large that people made changes, you know, in industries, for example, where you could see effluents, where you could see pollution. But very interestingly, in buildings, this number has been talked about for a number of years, but it is not visible. Nobody sees, you know, this 40% energy and so much CO2 and so much ozone. It's all happening in the buildings. You can see it in a factory, you can see it in a process. And that's why it's sort of hidden, and it doesn't really go anywhere. How to address it? I think it's the same principles everywhere. One is, of course, reduce. The other one is recycling. Recycling is at a different two, three levels. One is, of course, in recycling of waste and other things, but also, as we said, recycling the same resource again and again. Looking at, say, energy in this case, the example of combined heat and power. You don't let anything go waste. That form of energy is reused. Water is a very good example, that within a building, within a project, you can recycle water 5 times before it actually goes out. And finally, it's about finding solutions to very small and mundane problems. You know, at a global level, these are things that are discussed at Rio, and you try to find a generic solution, which is, in terms of energy efficiency in buildings, almost meaningless. Because there is no standard approach that one could take. It's only a vision that this is where we want to go. But and this is something we'll probably discover in our workshop tomorrow, that the problems we all face are very simple and are manageable. The barriers we face are also very simple. And many of the success stories, like the buildings that Millie showed, or the examples of new hotels and new buildings that are being built at half the levels earlier, shows that it can be done in today's context with all the challenges that we have. Now, the complexity has changed because our buildings have changed. Earlier, it didn't matter because our footprints were so small. You know, there was no transport. We saw that in a small city, you had only local materials. You had only skills that were local, and there was no processing of products so that you could create pollutants and things like that. In today's structure, anything that goes into as an input into a building, in a typical building, becomes a problem. So all the services and the resources that go in, energy becomes waste heat, water becomes sewage, solar radiation is a problem. So we start with all the positive resources, and we are not able to close the loop. And in our practice, our approach should be to just close the loops as locally. You don't have to close everything inside the building, but we saw again in all this the presentation since morning several examples where there are loops that are closed, where the loops that feed into each other at a scale where the problems are mitigated and one is able to reduce the final environmental impact to a large extent. Now, building sector in India is very interesting. The famous McKinsey report shows a growth rate of over 7% in our demand for electricity, and the growth of building sector per se is also envisioned at between 6 to 8, 10%. Residential buildings are not talked about, are not a part of our policy because of the exact, the hidden problem. Nobody sees in today's, if you look at buildings, the first thing that you see are large commercial buildings. You see malls, you see hotels, but on a per mall or a per hotel basis, yes, they are quite intensive. Per square meter, they're quite intensive. But if you look at the energy use and the opportunities for savings, it would all come to a large extent in residential buildings. And if you look at a systems perspective, it's not just the energy that is used in the building. So if you look at the projections, this is based on Planning Commission's report and the analysis that we've done. They talk about the shortages. And I'm not talking about the deficit today. Okay, between 2010 and 2030, there's a projection of over 70 million new houses are required to meet our requirement. There's a projection that says just urban 3 to 5 million new houses are required, housing stock, to meet our demand. Now, all of these projections also say that we will never be able to meet this demand. There will always be a large shortfall that will never be met, or will not be met, at least in this plan period. But in a typical residential unit now, let's see, we are adding 70 million new units. I'm talking about the typical urban household. You would look at refrigerator and ceiling fan, lighting, and other appliances. It's a broad categorization where this energy is going. And just the simple example that Dr. Mohanty gave, just use switching the easiest thing without changing anything, is appliances would reduce energy use, and so interestingly, it would also reduce the requirement for cooling and increase comfort a little bit. In a typical residential unit, there are savings of, and this analysis was done for an affordable housing project. So these are small two-room apartments which have basic services, one refrigerator and no air conditioner, ceiling fans. And if you just look at even an unconditioned house, you are looking at a savings that will pay back all the investments that go into making it more efficient. But then you look at the other aspect, which is the embodied energy of a typical unit. So when we did a detailed audit of this apartment, it says what is the energy that went into producing the materials for this house? And these were the components: reinforced concrete roof, slab, structure, brick wall, plaster. Typical affordable housing had steel door frames and stuff like that. And about 90% of the energy that goes in producing that house is in the outside structure and the frame, and almost half of it is in concrete that's a part of the building. Now, then we looked at what happens to the energy that gets used in running this versus the energy that is used in producing the materials for this building over 20 years. Typically the life cycle will be even longer. So we look at two scenarios. One is an unconditioned building. When it is built in the first year, almost 97-98% of the energy is the energy that went into making that house. And only a small part is used in running it, basically a ceiling fan and a refrigerator and a TV and things like that. And if you look at an air-conditioned house, it's a bigger percent. You're spending about 9% of the equivalent of the total energy. And as it keeps adding up. So this is the 20th year. It's not that in year 20. It's in 20 years, it's added up to that proportion. which means that after 20 years in a residential building, which is not air-conditioned, even if you use any kind of fossil fuel and inefficient appliances, the energy that went into material still outweighs the energy that's been used in the building, 60 to 40. And if it's a air-conditioned building, and this was for done for Mumbai and Delhi, so and similar results, you still have almost 30%, one-third of energy after 20 years is still. So when you multiply this by 70 million houses that need to be added over the next 20 years, the biggest impact of construction and building energy, building use, building design and building construction of energy is in the material, much, much, much more than what we will see in the end use. There is a change in lifestyle, and we are of course seeing a lot more air-conditioned households, and that trend, I mean, air conditioner sales in India for domestic air conditioners is growing at 25% a year. 25% a year. Okay, all the air conditioning companies are seeing that kind of growth. So we do see that there is a, you know, there will be a balance between these two numbers. But unless the construction practices change, and that's why I'm always excited to look at Orwell as an example, where there have been fantastic examples of low energy materials, construction technologies that are being now scaled up. I mean, I don't think you guys hear it very often, but recently, you know, we've been looking at affordable housing projects. So in Maharashtra, there are these developers who are making housing for economically weaker section. They've been, one developer is making 30,000 houses, right? And we went with this fantastic analysis. Oh, you do this kind of roof, this alternate material for wall, and compressed earth block, and you will, you know, you will be green. You'll have. And this guy looked at him and says, you know, I didn't expect that. I thought you'd come up with some fantastic new technology. All this stuff we've been doing because it's the cheapest way to build. You know, steel and cement are the two most expensive things that go into a building. It's his profitability increases if he doesn't use that. Their problem has been to find enough people to do it, but they've experimented, and now there are thousands, it's not a few, of houses which are ground plus three stories for a large number of people that are being used, being built with the technologies that, in a way, were pioneered here.
Now, in India, our drivers are the lack of resources more than anything else. When I talk to potential occupants or owners of buildings, their primary reason for looking at energy efficiency is not environmental protection. It's just that there is not enough electricity. There's not enough power to meet the demand. And that's a real need for which people are willing to pay. The NHB program for energy efficient housing that Millie talked about, when we were designing that program, we did a survey in three cities, in Delhi, Mumbai, and Bangalore. And we asked people, is energy efficiency important for you? And questions like that. It's very interesting. So we first did a questionnaire without prompting anyone about energy efficiency, and it didn't show anywhere. You know, people were more interested in their own location, the color of the walls, and, you know, all these other things. The moment you talk about performance, daylighting, natural ventilation, comfort, it jumps into the top five priorities that people would have. But almost 80% of the people said that they would prefer something that is more efficient, if they understood the concept. And almost 70% said that they're willing to pay more for it. And I'm not talking about the super rich here. These are apartments that were one and two bedroom apartments in all of these cities, which is the most common requirement now. And they were willing to pay with a catch. The catch was that they did not trust the developer's claim. Just by my saying that this is energy efficient, they're not going to pay for it. So
that's why this whole certification program is coming into being, where a government agency is going to certify that this energy efficient, and clearly you'll see that transformation in this year in these buildings. This is the GHG potential. Okay. Now, I'm just repeating this, but there are enough number of policies and programs for energy efficiency now. The Act, the Integrated Energy Policies, there are many state-level initiatives, and there are federal initiatives now. Some of the important ones I'll go through. The Energy Conservation Building Code, this was 2005 study, and this is primarily for medium to large commercial, institutional, non-residential building, let's say. And it shows, these are two kinds of buildings. This is 24-hour use, and these are data and use buildings. Even conservatively, a saving of about, say, 25 to 27% for a mild climate like Bangalore to almost 40%, 35 to 40% savings in cities like Chennai, Kolkata, and Mumbai, and Delhi, which are hot and humid, just by adoption of a minimum standard. You know, and it's not a super aggressive standard. This is in place. There is an issue with mandatory compliance, and maybe if we find time, we'll talk about it later. But it is happening. Currently, the objective is in the next plan year, that means by 2017, all states have to make this mandatory. So you will see in the next 5 years, again, just like the transformation in the residential sector, energy efficiency in non-residential buildings, at least the baseline is going to go up. The baseline will go up a little bit. We still have the challenge of, you know, making super efficient buildings and integrating other things. The second successful program is, of course, the standards and labeling program. And it is being extended to cover over the next 5 years again. There's a plan to add 50 new appliances to this. There's a current program to, and another study done for this one showed that the top priority for labeling and standards are all the things that have something to do with cooling. So air conditioners, chillers, storage, these cold storage units, refrigerated warehouses, there's a tremendous growth in these mobile cold storage vehicles. Those are some of the, you know, they're typically all growing at 20-25% more, and you see very stringent regulations for all of them. And of course, there are other initiatives like standards and labeling program. There's a new one for affordable housing. So the National Housing Bank is coming up with a loan program for affordable housing, where they are giving a big discount for making it energy efficient. Now, that definition of what is energy efficient for an affordable housing is still to be sort of to be put together, but that's a rider for this program. Okay, and there are many financing programs. I think the utility tariff incentives, as we heard, are being developed. Cities like Pune Municipal Corporation has a 10% rebate on property taxes. State Bank of India gives a 25 basis point reduction in interest rate. And one of the most interesting experiments is now in just adjacent to Delhi, Noida. You get 5% extra FAR if you make an energy efficient building. And you know, you will see that now there is no building that is not green in Noida, at least certified green. Not a single one, because that value of that 5% extra floor area is like gold, you know. And it will have an interesting effect. Just came in effect last year, but you can already see that suppliers of simple things like double glazing to these housing units, none of them had double glazing. You know, in Delhi climate, when it's so hot and sometimes so cold, you need an insulated window. The prices have come down drastically. The price differential between a good single and a double glazed window has halved in the last 1 year. Okay, and you'll see many, many such effects, which will affect the rest of the country as well. And now Delhi and others, Gurgaon, are looking at the same thing.
Another study we did was to look at what else can be done to incentivize and promote energy efficiency in buildings. It's a big list, okay? We looked at about 17 odd measures, including the white certificates and depreciation benefits of replacement, net zero energy target for building codes. What are the various policy scenarios and what is it that we can save? And what are the barriers that each one of these policy programs address, whether it's a policy or a finance or awareness? And finally, the savings that they yield. And this is what I was talking about. So the GSM and utility incentive programs have one of the largest impact in the next 20 years because we don't realize the existing stock of residential and non-residential buildings that we have. And even when we have a stringent appliance in a building code, you would find that in the best of the scenarios, you're looking at a 50% compliance rate, which is a big, you know, even in developed countries and economies, you don't have more than 50% compliance rate. So there is that every year you're adding that stock of non-compliant and potential savings. Now, there were two things that we analyzed that far exceeded any of this. And, you know, it was a short study, so we couldn't put our hands around the numbers because there were multiple times of this. One was the zoning and the development plan of our cities and the urban growth model within the cities. These two macro-level policies would outstrip any of these. And it was very interesting because we did this program, this analysis for Shakti Foundation and for Bureau of Energy Efficiency. Those two things didn't fall in anybody's domain. So the challenge was that energy efficiency and zoning planning is not, they're not the same department. And similarly, urban growth models to look at when Delhi is developing its master plan, are we looking at integrated transportation patterns? Are we looking at mixed-use development? Are we encouraging transport-oriented developments? It's not, it's a question of jurisdictions. And unless this change of thought happens at the large, at a higher level, you're not actually getting there. So we map the barriers. I think you all know about this. But what can be done? So we identify three barriers to energy efficiency in buildings. One is market failures, where there, you know, it's to everybody's advantage to have a product and have a service that is better and more efficient. And even the best of the architects and engineers today face this challenge that they cannot find something that meets their requirement. Either there's insufficient information, or there is no guarantee, or, I mean, I know, for example, in many of the projects you've done, you'll find something that only one vendor has, or maybe three have, and they have different specs. So market has not been able to respond even to the small demand that we have. Second is, you know this, don't look at life cycle costs, we look at high discount rates to evaluate energy efficient savings. This is another very, very big import. When I look at these 20-year savings, and you put in inflation and you put in a discount rate of 5% or 10% on this, the net present value of these savings is nothing. Right? So we are not able to account for the escalation in energy prices and inflation in a way that we can account for the future savings in a realistic way. And finally, this is the biggest one, that the decision making are the bodies, and this is I'm talking about the political bodies and the organizations that set these policies, they have many, many, many more things that are more worrisome to them than this. So the resources at the policy level to implement any of this, the resources at an organization level are just not there. And a lot of the effort needs to go in just building or providing that capacity. Okay, so there is a vision that is for buildings based on, you know, again, Dr. Mahanti talked about it. You have buildings today that are maybe 250, 300 kilowatt hours if you look at the entire stock of buildings. So these are all the buildings in the country. The current energy conservation building code, if you use that, would peg the building at about 180 odd kilowatt hours per square meter per year. And there are many high performance buildings that are
doing much better than that, say about 100 odd kilowatt hours. So this is the scenario in 2010.
The 2030 vision
is to actually have a 2020 vision is that 150, 180 number that we have to make that mandatory. And this is what is happening now. So at least the median of new construction will come up there. You will still have high performance buildings that will be maybe slightly better. You'll have net zero buildings that's happening, and you will have a few pioneering net energy positive buildings. And this is, we can foresee this. This is happening in the next, by 2020, we would expect to see some of these buildings.
And at that point, we set the next code requirement
for 2030. So that means between 2020 and 2030, the ECBC gets more stringent, and you find many, many more buildings that are now doing better than this. Okay, this is not very aggressive. This is in fact doable, looking at the time frame that we have. And what is required is that there's a minimum standard that cuts off all new construction that is happening in this inefficient way that at least will come in this. These are all the existing buildings. So how do you move all these existing buildings into this? This block is only by providing incentive programs and DSN and other. All the new construction comes here because they, by regulation, will have to meet that. And then to go to net energy positive, you need an integrated renewable energy policy that supports the building. So with this vision, the new energy efficiency standard, inshallah, we're going to start now, which will be the next update to ECBC, which has a vision that by 2030, we move toward a net zero standard.
So that's the codes and standards. This is market driven, and this is innovation. This is how we will get there. Now this is the framework of what we will talk about tomorrow. That
how do you design buildings to this? First thing is to clear and quantify goals. We find that the moment you set those, rest of the things follow. And it's not done in design projects. You don't set quantifiable goals very often of what is the performance that you want. That is an outcome you get in the end. But we need to set that in the beginning. The last part of this is look at a way to measure and refine the performance.
Now, I'm going to skip a few slides, and we'll see some examples. Right. So one is the change. What is the change in the design process?
The design process needs to include some sort of this is not what is recommended, but typically in a project now you have all these people and they need to work together. You may have a subset, but whoever, maybe one team does everything, they need to work together. The second important thing is to look at it from day one. The problem is to look at the issue of sustainability, energy efficiency as an add-on. That has to be on the agenda on the first day. And through the process to stay focused on this.
Because, again, we know the process of construction is so tedious, design and construction. It's very easy to not meet these goals because there are immediate pressures of doing other things that are more pressing, trade-offs to be made. But these trade-offs sometimes are to be accepted. Another problem we feel that,
we as environmental architects sometimes also put off our clients because we don't do trade-offs. We don't accept their versions of the story. That the cost is a real issue for him. That there may be, we are advocating this issue of life cycle cost, and we don't provide that fellow a business model through which that cost is recovered, then it is in real sense a loss for him. So we can't just say, no, this is how it is, this life cycle cost is very important. We also, so architects have to innovate to become also financial advisors and to develop business models. And we've been successfully doing that for, say, large, core and shell buildings by showing that if you do this, you can reduce your utility cost by 2 rupees a square foot and still charge what the market charges and recover that. And you know, that has been an argument that has been able to convert a lot of decisions.
And so this basically, you have to trade off, you have to explore synergies and also know when to stop.
Another problem we have with the really high efficiency projects is never stop. You know, and really it becomes a deterrent for the next project. So, as we said, incremental change. You look at one thing, do it, measure it, and move on to the next one. We get caught up in our own, you know, in many, many projects we see that.
So, tomorrow we will go through this process of each phase, doing design, specification, procurement, construction.
What is it that we can do to make the project more energy efficient?
These are the various activities one does in each phase. And set the goals for comfort, aesthetics, efficiency, and achieve those. Okay. Now, I'm going to just go through an example. A very quick one. This is a factory building in Noida, designed by Sanjay Prakash and landscape architect Mohan Rao for Bangalore, and we were the energy efficiency and sustainable design or construction consultants for these,
and this was also aiming for a certification, so this achieved a platinum. And I'm only going to highlight one or two aspects of this. This is a factory that just got commissioned in Noida in an urban plot in a very dense situation where, you know, there was hardly a setback of 2 meters, 5 meters and 5 meters, and then you had buildings on both sides. And this is an owner which already is running 3 other factories in that area. So they had all the data, and they thought that they'd done everything, right? In this project, the most interesting thing was how did we change the mindset. So today we have measured saving of 55% to 60%. Metered savings compared to the owner who has 3 other factories running and with a higher level of service. So this is a garment factory, and